door. She's down to her final shot here. Can you believe it? The American Ninja Warrior podcast starts now.
It is the American Ninja Warrior podcast with your hosts. I'm Matt Eisman.
And I'm Akbar Bajabiamila.
And we are in finals mode. We just wrapped up the last of our city finals in Minneapolis. And now we know who's going to Vegas and what a way to finish it up. After having 14 finishers in qualifying, we had five finishers tied with Dallas for the second most. We just saw a real step up this season in the city finals in the athletes.
Well, Matt, we really did. And especially you talk about Minneapolis, and we really talked about this before, that the gyms that are popping up in Minneapolis and how many ninjas are out there training. That's why we saw such a good run in Minneapolis.
Well, I think you were excited to see the giant, John Alexis Jr.
Yes.
Fastest time of the night. Good to see a big man. A big man can still move fast.
Somebody's got to represent because there is still
good
that
good to see
nothing.
A big man could move fast. You didn't get that.
No.
Good to see a big man could move fast.
What are you trying to say about me, man? Hey, look
giant,
here.
He
I tried.
Great.
Yeah,
hey,
I know,
no,
but I look slow.
I'm giving you credit. You were great.
But
you were
I will
great,
say
but the
this,
big man
though,
was
but,
great.
You know, there's still that notion out there that ninjas are a certain height. John Alexis Jr., 6'6", he's representing, saying, look, the big guys, the big women, they can come out there, the tall women can come out there and compete.
Well, and speaking of women, it was a bit of a surprise. Meghan Martin, no surprise, of course, finishing tops amongst the women. But Abby Clark, and, you know, we talked to Sarah Schoback and Beeston Heeson, two women we thought they'd be going head-to-head
yeah.
along with Meghan Martin for those coveted two spots for the women. But instead, Abby Clark steps up and gets that second spot right behind Meghan Martin.
24 years old. Her second season, second year competing on Ninja Warrior. I mean, to be that good in her second year as a sophomore of Ninja Warrior, that's not a common thing. That's not a given. We've seen a lot of success, but there's also a ton of failure, especially with these ninjas. And I'm super excited to see what Abby Clark is going to do in Las Vegas.
I'm also excited to see Ian Dory, one of the Wolfpack, the guy who we used to call the Wolf Pup. But he, as we head into Vegas, he has to be one of the favorites to win it all. And what a great performance he had.
Yeah, Matt, we've seen over the years his strength, his endurance, his agility. I mean, Ian Dora really does have a lot of the same qualities that we see in a guy like Drew Dreschel. Of course, Drew Dreschel's considered the real-life ninja, but Ian Dora, you got to watch out. He could be one of those guys.
Coming from different backgrounds. That's what I love. Yes. We've got the guy, Drew Dreschel, who's much more parkour-based.
Rock climber.
Then we've got rock climber with Ian Dora, and to see whose skills will triumph, it's really going to depend on the course. But we also have a sit down today, and you handle this one on your own because
yes.
I was tired.
You were tired. You were tired.
I'll be honest. I wasn't globetrotting. I wasn't doing anything like that. Matt Eisman just occasionally needs a rest. And the big man, you got to sit down with the giving ninja.
Yeah,
Sean Darling-Hammond.
Matt, the one thing I love about Sean Darling-Hammond, I think everyone, when you watch the show, you see Sean Darling-Hammond, it's his smile, his infectious smile that, you know, lights up a TV screen. But I really got a chance to understand who he is and why he's smiling. And this is going to be a great sit down when you listen to Sean Darling-Hammond. And I'm so happy that he's been successful. We saw his success in Minneapolis, and now you get to see what makes him a good dude.
Well, I can't wait to hear it along with everyone else. Akbar Bajabiamila talking to Sean Darling-Hammond.
It's a lot of letters right there.
It is.
Enjoy.
And we are pleased to be joined by one of my favorite ninja warriors, Sean Darling-Hammond. You know why you are one of my favorite ninjas?
Why?
Because you have a hyphenated name. And my name used to be hyphenated.
I know it.
And so I took it out. There's no hyphenation. Do you know how to say it?
It's Akbar Aulakemi Idowu Kubajabiamila.
Okay, you added the G. The G is silent.
No!
But you were good. You were
good.
Yeah, I give you a 94% on that.
94%? I practiced it, man.
So why is your name hyphenated?
So my mom's last name is Darling. My dad's last name is Hammond. They were both kind of in that hippie era where people came together and didn't want to have one gender sort of dominate the name. So they hyphenated it.
Wow. If that happened in my family, I don't think anybody would ever say my name.
So is it true that Idowu means followed by twins or like
born
after
twins?
Yeah.
Well, look at you. You've been doing your research.
You know, a little Yoruba.
Yeah, yes.
Trying to learn a little bit.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll teach you how to say hello, which is Baoni.
Baoni.
Yeah, there you go.
That's all awesome.
Right, so next time I say it, you say Baoni.
Baoni.
Yeah. That? But, you know, I look at that. You've gone from the hyphenated name Darling Hammond, and you have a smile that lights up a city from here in Los Angeles to Bangor, Maine. Why are you always so happy? What does that smile come from?
Yeah, so I think there's two reasons I'm so happy. One is life's just a crazy gift, man. Like, we're on a massive rock hurtling through space at millions of miles per hour, wrapping around a ball of helium. Like, that's insane. And in that situation, we get to have all this joy and connection, and it just blows my mind. So, like, life is a gift.
Yeah, it comes through. It comes through when you're running, and whereas a lot of the other ninjas, they've got that serious focus look and sometimes intimidating look. Every time you complete an obstacle, you get around and you throw up the hearts and you're smiling. And I'm like, is this fun for you? I mean, clearly it seems very fun, but what does intensity mean, and how does it look like for Sean Darling Hammond?
So intensity for me is intensely enjoying every opportunity. There's a phrase in Japanese, ichigo ichie, which means every experience in life happens one time. You don't want to miss it. You want to really enjoy those moments because they're fleeting. And I think I've seen a lot of really close friends pass away. I've seen, you know, things happen to people that are just unfair. And you never know when bad luck's around the corner. So you want to enjoy every amazing experience you have. And that's what Ninja is for me. It's an amazing experience.
Well, that first year, talking about experience, your first year, it's not typical for a lot of rookies. You make it to Las Vegas. What was that like, your very first year, season 7, on Ninja Warrior? You finished the qualifying round. You didn't get past in the finals, but you make it to Vegas, though. It ran fast enough to make it to Vegas. What was that like?
Surreal. It was completely surreal. Honestly, it started being surreal the second I got the call to compete. You know, I'm a dork, right? Like, I'm sitting there in chambers as a law clerk, you know, I'm like, I'm basically Steve Urkel over here, and I get the call to compete among some of the most talented athletes in the world against the hardest obstacles in the world. It's a dream come true for me, you know, like, I've never been the quintessential athlete. I wasn't NFL caliber, man. Okay. Like, you know, I wasn't that guy. So it started being crazy even then. And then to go out there and all the training sort of paying off in that first moment, it was just completely
surreal.
How did
you get introduced to Ninja Warrior? Because, you know, you're saying being a law clerk, but you don't see a lot of law clerks coming to Ninja Warrior in their first qualifying round, finishing it, get to the finals in the city finals, and that was back in Pittsburgh, and you make it to the 9th obstacle. You needed one more obstacle to hit that buzzer to the top.
Yeah, and, still,
you
know, hurts.
Were you doing ninja training, or were you just kind of casually in shape?
So it might not surprise you, I didn't hear it from one of my law clerk colleagues. No one was like doing it in the office. Justin Kidd, who is another Ninja Warrior, he competed seasons, I think, 4, 5, and 6. He had been doing it for a while, and we were both at the same climbing gym. And we were two of the only black dudes at that climbing gym, so we sort of globbed onto each other. And he was like, you know what? I think you'd be really good at ninja. You seem to like to do powerful things in the gym. You like to pull hard and fly far. Start training for it, apply, see what happens. So I started going to Alternate Roots, a little gym in Maryland. Tony Torres created it long ago, before ninja gyms were all over the place. It's a really sketchy gym. There's like screws everywhere. Like, now it's a lot better. So Tony, I'm not calling you out, brother. It's really safe now. But back in the day, it was kind of like, it was cobbled together. It was mom and pop-ish. And it was a really great place to kind of fall in love with it. It felt really intimate. So I trained there for ninja, and going from the mom and pop-ish obstacles that could break at any time to the course was like an upgrade. Like, no, I'm not gonna get hurt, I just fall in the water. So I was ready, I think, mentally to like commit to things and go for it. And I think that's what a lot of people don't have their first time, is that willingness to go for it and not be afraid.
So your season 8, you get disqualified. And so you really didn't get a chance to have a sophomore slump, although you could look at it as a sophomore slump because you got disqualified.
Yeah.
But that junior season, your third year on Ninja Warrior, you picked up.
Yeah, season 9 was remarkable, man. It was a result of me doing something that a lot of ninjas, I think, figure out, is the mental training is even more important than the physical training. Season 7, I think I came into it, and you know how like the first time you do anything, you almost have like beginner's luck?
Yeah.
I felt like I had a little bit of that, and it carried me through season 7. Season 8, it ran out, and I didn't do as well, and I wasn't mentally in the game. So season 9, I picked up this book called You Are a Bad ASS. I don't know if I can say it on
the
radio.
I think you can say it, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You Are a Badass. It's a really great book. It's all about trying to realize your own inner strength and overcome your own fears and just tap into the potential that you have. And I was reading that before I got on the course. I was really getting in the zone, getting excited, believing in my ability to do things that I didn't think I could do before. And when I got on the course, it was like, all right, it's happening. So that's what season 9 was for me, was this moment where I was letting myself live out my potential in front of this incredibly supportive crowd.
You follow that up in Vegas, and you get to that second stage. Were you out of your mind? Did you see that coming in season 9? Did you know that you would make it to stage 2 in the finals?
So this is going to sound contradictory, but on the one hand, yeah, I did. I really started letting myself believe in my potential. So I thought I was going to go to stage 3. I was ready mentally for that. On the other hand, it was insanely surprising. And I was so grateful when it happened. When I finished stage 1, I'm pretty sure the cameras caught this, but it never was shown. And I'm grateful for that. I cried like a little baby. Like I fell on the
platform. Why did you cry?
I think we all have this built-up voice that tells us you can't do this, you'll never do that. And like I was a fat kid, I was asthmatic. I was never thinking of myself as someone who could overcome the toughest obstacles in the world. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. They sort of have this doubt that is stronger sometimes than their hope. And when I beat stage 1, when I hit that buzzer, you know, I have watched this show since I was a kid. I've seen people hit that buzzer and looked up to them. And to think I was gonna be, and I was in that moment, someone doing that, it was this moment where the doubt just had to stop. You know, the doubting voice was just silenced, and all I was left was gratitude.
Yeah, I call that life commandments. And we hear and get these life commandments, whether it's stuff that we are having internally or we hear from other people, like, you'll never be able to be that. Like, hey, I want to be the president. Come on. You know what that takes. And all of a sudden, these commandments start to rule your life. Mm. When did you put a stop? And do you remember that defining moment where you said, I now have to take over? I am now in control of my own destiny, because those inner voices, they're real.
Yeah. For me, the moment actually was when I was switching careers, which happened between seasons 8 and 9. I was in a law firm and it was just draining me. And one of my life commandments, to use your terminology, was you'll never be happy unless you pay off your law school loans. I had a ton of debt. I still have a good amount, but felt like I had to work at this job that was draining my soul in order to pay off loans. And I would never be a good provider for my wife. I would never be a good member of society if I didn't just suck it up, go to work, get it done, pay the loans. Like, I thought I really had to do that. And at some point, it became totally unsustainable and so out of character for me. I wasn't making a difference in people's lives. I didn't feel like myself anymore. And I was like, that life commandment is wrong. That's not me. I don't need to worry about paying some banker money back as fast as possible. I need to worry about making people's lives better as fast as possible, because tomorrow's not guaranteed. And that was the moment that sort of kicked off this letting go of doubts and beliefs that had sort of been given to me.
Is there a certain esteem? I guess I would want to go back to what made you get into that profession. Why'd you study law? Why'd you want to become I assume that you wanted to become a lawyer.
Yeah. One would hope, right? Yeah. Otherwise, if you're going to law school to become a doctor, you've made a mistake. You've made a mistake along the way. Yeah, I really believed, I was an idealist. I really believed people go to law school and you've got these visions of them in the courtroom defending people's rights, you know? Like
Perry Mason.
Yeah, right? Like, I thought I was going to be Perry Mason. I thought I was going to be out there making sure every kid had a great education in the courtroom and telling people, like, you cannot stop Jimmy from going to school. Jimmy will go to school. Like, I thought that was going to be my life. I was wrong. It turns out that there's a lot of dues paying before you get to be an impact litigator. That's what that sort of role is, when you're the first chair in a big lawsuit to try to expand people's rights. There's a lot of dues paying. So if you stick with it, 10 years down the line, maybe you do get to do that kind of work. But in those 10 years, you're making money for other people who are having contentious battles about things that I don't think matter as much as Jimmy going to school. So that was the sort of the bait and switch that I fell into.
Yeah, and what was it about? Because you've now moved from that into now public policy.
Yeah.
You're at UC Berkeley now.
Yep.
And you're studying public policy. What is it that Sean Darling Hammond wants to change?
Two things. I want to make sure really, truly, deeply, that every kid has an opportunity to feel loved and really trusted and respected and acknowledged for their value.
Where does that come from?
It's funny. I knew this question was coming, but it still feels I'm not going to cry. Because they got me with this question in the interview that I did in Minnesota. I started crying. Hopefully, they don't show. It's the second time I've cried on camera for the show.
But we keep it real. We keep it 100.
It's true. And I heard Grant's interview, and that was so real and so beautiful. So I will be honest. It comes from watching a lot of my peers growing up. I went to public school in New York. I went to public school before I sort of realized that wasn't working for me and moved into a different school system in California. It came from watching a lot of my peers not be respected, not be acknowledged, and decide that the only way they could get respect was to join a gang or to do things that weren't going to be productive for their lives. And some of them are dead. You know, I went back to New Rochelle where I was in school, in middle school and elementary school. I went back and a good number of the kids that I was in band with, that I looked up to, people who are a year above me, they were in jail or dead. And that's not uncommon. You talk to almost anybody who went to a public school in inner city or nearby it, and they're like, oh yeah, you know, a lot of people end up in jail, a lot of people end up dead. It shouldn't be that way. That should be so incredibly rare that a kid is sort of written off at that stage. You know, you look at like expulsions, there are preschoolers getting expelled in this country. Four-year-olds getting expelled, getting told like, you don't belong. Four-year-olds, they don't know right from wrong yet. That's our job. That's adult's job to teach them that. So what is it that I want? I want every kid to have that opportunity all the way until they're an adult and they can make mistakes and we can judge them for it, right? All the way until they're an adult to be accepted and loved and respected.
Right. How do you do that when you have this systemic breakdown in our educational system? Because, you know, that tapped something inside of me, because I grew up in the inner city locally here in South Central Los Angeles, went to Crenshaw High School. And, you know, I had a lot of those restrictions and I was surrounded with a lot of these things that you're talking about, from the gang temptation and so on and so forth. And when you have a lot of the homes are broken, or you're having a lot of fighting at home, it can make it hard for a kid to succeed in those circumstances. What needs to happen, from funding to all that stuff? How do you see that really, like if you had to put your stamp on it, it's like, this is how we're going to change it. How would you change it?
So fortunately, I don't have to come up with the panacea, because smarter people have already come up with good things. It's sort of, I see my job as elevating what's been working and figuring out what makes it work. And one of the things that really works is what's called restorative justice. And it's about relationship building. So if somebody makes a mistake in a school, you try to make sure that their relationship to the teacher is improved, their relationship to their peers is improved. So they feel like, you know what? I'm not going to do that again, because I'm letting so-and-so down. I'm letting myself down. I trust myself. I respect myself and I respect them. It's about building that up. Instead of saying, so-and-so made a mistake, the only way we're going to change their behavior is by treating them like dirt. Right? Like, we just got the psychology wrong at some point. And we were so afraid of kids doing bad things that we thought we need to be as punitive as possible. But restorative justice seems to work really, really well. In Oakland, where I am now, Oakland Unified School District has seen a huge reduction in suspensions and expulsions, growth in graduation rates, growth in reading test scores, all through using restorative justice programs. So that's a big part of what I'm doing in my PhD, is figuring out why it works there and how we can spread that to other school districts.
You know, that's powerful. And I just got it now, why they call you the giving ninja. I mean, you deserve that title. I was like, well, what is he giving? I mean, I didn't know if you were like Oprah and he's like, hey, you
look
get
under
this.
Your seat.
And you get that. I didn't know, but I get it, because the most valuable resource a man has is time. And you're definitely using that. You're giving your time to try to think of different ways to further these kids' lives. And I think you should be commended for that. It's great that you're thinking about that, 33 years old, and you're already starting to move in that direction. Going back to your childhood, what was your childhood like for you?
It was awesome in a lot of ways. The things that, you know, there are like these memories that are super salient, that you like remember yourself as a little kid and you're like, oh, what was it like? I remember my dad and my mom, both of whom are mixed, actually. A lot of people don't know that. I'm sort of like the classic only in America kind of kid. My dad is Irish, Cherokee, and French, and my mom is Irish, French. Native American on my dad's side. My mom is Irish, French, and African American as well. So both parents are mixed. And growing up, they would always tell me, like, you can't hate or dislike anyone without hating a member of your family. And that really expanded my sense of the human family. So my mom actually asked my mom, you know, what was my childhood like last night? Because I was like, I've got Akbar Baja Biamila talking to me, and I don't want to, you know, sound silly. So tell me what I was like. She was like, you know, when I would pick you up at school, you'd be high-fiving all the kids. They'd be like, hey, what's up, Sean? You know, and there's like a super diverse school in New York. And I think I attribute that to my parents telling me that everybody was a member of my family. So like the little Indian girl, the little black boy, the little, it didn't matter. Everybody was just a boy or a girl or another kid that I wanted to be cool with.
So let me ask you, because this is an interesting question and a lot of people run away from this. Mm. How do you identify yourself? Because you grow up in my wife is mixed race. Mm. And I know that she struggled with that. Did you struggle with that as far as identity, especially living in a world where identities, you get your test in front of you and there's only a certain amount of boxes. Like, hold on, what was that like for you growing up?
You know, and I think my experience is a testament to how, no matter how hard parents try, it's still hard.
Yeah.
My parents are very educated on race and diaspora and all that stuff. And they told me, like, listen, you're mixed, but people are going to see you as black, but you can choose what you want to be. Race is an identity. It's not genetic. They told me all that stuff. Didn't matter. I got to school and I was this light-skinned black kid. So in a really racially charged environment, which I happened to be in New Rochelle, the white kids were like, this kid's black, we don't like him. And the black kids were like, this kid's too white, we don't like him. So I got bullied a lot. I remember I was in elementary school, and I used to walk home and be like, what areas do I avoid so I don't get jumped? Because kids are getting jumped. And I had been beat up before. And I was like, this is wrong, you know? Like, why can't I just get along with people? Like, can't we all just get along? Like, I literally thought that as a kid. So I did struggle with, you know, what identity would not only make me feel like I was myself, but would make me safe. And I think that's a big part of why I really strive to make everybody, no matter where they come from, feel extremely included and loved. Because that's something that I know when you don't have it, it's like a core piece of you is missing.
Yeah. Is that why you throw up the heart?
Yeah, it's a big part of it.
Yeah, because you know, after every obstacle, you're throwing up the heart and you got that smile going on and people are feeling it. What the story behind that is what?
I love everyone and I want everyone to love everyone and love themselves. You know, and I feel like there are very few forces in the universe that can overcome anything, that can overcome hatred and doubt and anything. And love is one of those forces.
Okay. Let's move to this new challenge that you've taken on. You've taken on a new challenge of learning how to do backflips.
Oh, God.
what made you do that at 30-something years old?
There is a story behind that. So fear. I want to conquer fear. When I was 17, it was my 17th birthday party. We had a bounce house. I mean, like, clearly I don't know how to mature. At 17, I have a bounce house. At 33, I'm on an adult kid course. Like, I don't know how to be an adult.
That's all right.
I'm still in school at 33, right? But at 17, we had this bounce house and I tried to do a front flip and I knocked my own tooth out of my mouth, my front right tooth. And ever since then, I've been terrified of inversions, of going head over feet or head under feet, I guess. So I'm in my 30s and I'm doing this Ninja Warrior thing. And I'm like, you know what? It's time to just let go of all the fears. So I asked Jamie Ron, I asked other buddies of mine to show me how to do different kinds of flips. So I've been doing that the last year to really overcome fear.
Can you do a backflip now?
Not right now on hard ground.
No, but can you, have you accomplished it by yourself?
I've done backflips.
Wow, that's pretty hard because my son is learning how to do backflips. Actually, he knows how to do a backflip. And I thought to myself, at 39 years old, but I have that same fear. So my question is to you is, and I guess this would apply in life, how do you overcome a massive fear? I don't want to, what goes through my head is, I'm going to get to a certain point and I'm going to drop and break my neck.
Yep.
And die.
It's not just you. It's like our wiring as human beings is telling you that, because I'm sure at some point cavemen tried that and they didn't reproduce.
Yeah.
And so we have this fear that's almost genetic.
What did it take? Because that really is a strong key. What did it take to overcome that fear? Because I want to, but I don't want to die.
So a big thing, and this is true for parkour and for ninja in particular, is to find ways to sort of scale it back and learn the skill at a good pace so that it's safe the first time you try it. So the first time I did a backflip, I did it into a foam pit. So I'm just jumping back. And if I under-rotate, I'm landing on cubes that are made of foam. Nothing bad happens. And you find that you tend not to under-rotate your first time. You just needed that sort of cushion to know that if you screwed it up, you'd be fine, right? So you do a bunch of them into the foam pit, then you go from there to the next level and to the next level. And then eventually you're like, I've done 100 backflips that were safer than hard ground. I'm ready for hard ground. And then you do it there.
Oh, that's pretty cool. All right. I'm going to get in a foam pit and try it.
Yeah, man. Yeah. That's the way.
Yeah, okay. So Ninja Warrior, getting back to American Ninja Warrior, what does it need? What do you need to do in your game to be able to elevate yourself to becoming the next American Ninja Warrior? Man. And have you seen that and made that as a goal of yours?
Yeah. There's one big thing that I realized the season that I got disqualified, season 8, and that was parkour and footwork. I never wanted, again, to be facing down a balance obstacle and think, well, this is where my season's going to end. Because I literally thought that season 8. I looked at the paddle boards, and it felt like they were a mile long. Like, it's really only, whatever, 12 feet, and there's water underneath it, but it felt like a mile.
It's an optical illusion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I never wanted to feel like that again. So I've trained parkour. I've trained footwork a lot, and that's helped. The other piece of it is just making sure I'm mentally in the game. You can do insane things if you believe you can do insane things.
Yeah, well, one of the insane things I heard that you do is you play basketball at UC Berkeley to stay in shape. You might be the only ninja I know that does that plays basketball with the 21-year-olds on campus.
I have always loved basketball. I know you played in Crenshaw.
I love basketball.
Had two championships there.
That's right.
Yeah. What was the coach? Willie
West.
Willie West, legend. Man. Yeah.
Yeah.
I am envious of you winning those championships. Yeah. That's so cool, man.
Are you pretty good at basketball?
I think so.
Who's the best basketball ninja that you have? That you played?
You know
with
what? This is going to surprise you. It's probably Chris Wilczewski.
Chris Wilczewski can play basketball?
He's a sleeper. Watch out. He's super quick. He's got a really good release on his jump shot. He's
like Steph Curry?
Yeah, he's Curry-ish. Okay. I'm not going to lie. He's Curry-ish. He knows how to get it up. I played with him after the National Ninja League finals. We were all like done and relaxing. It's always like that. You compete and then you're like, oh, now I can do crazy things and get injured if I want. So we're all playing basketball, not worrying about our ankles. I was shocked.
Give me your starting five. John Alexis.
He's center.
Okay.
Chris Wilczewski. He's a guard. I'm point guard.
Okay. So you got your one and your two, and you got your five. You need a three and a four.
I'm going to go Jessie Lebrecht.
Jessie Lebrecht. Okay, yeah. At the three?
She's going to play the three.
Okay.
We played a lot of knockout when I visited them in Chicago.
Jessie got a jumper?
She got a jumper. She knows how to sink it. So I trust her. If I hit her in a corner block, she's going to sink it.
Okay.
You know? And she's a competitor too. And the other is going to be Brian Wilczewski. He's scrappy as all get up. So it was me and Chris and Brian on a team.
Okay.
Yeah, against Michael Johnson, you know, ice in his veins,
yep.
Michael Johnson,
yep.
And two other dudes from Atlanta. And we put up a fight. So I would want to play with them.
That's
again.
Your starting
That's
five.
That's my five right there.
You might be able to get an NBA championship with that one.
I don't know, man. I've been watching the finals. Warriors look unbeatable forever.
Outright. Yeah. Well, you guys look like you guys are all going to have J's for days. So, well, you know, so you go from basketball and you're using that as part of your training. What does your training regimen look like? Everyone has a different regimen for their training, which is kind of unique because I've trained with Sarah Schoback. Mm. I've trained with Jesse Graff. I've trained with Drew Dreschel a little bit, Flip Rodriguez, Kevin Bull. And what I notice is that all of their training is a little different. Is there something that makes Sean Darling Hammond, I just like saying your full name, Sean Darling Hammond's training different from the other ninjas that maybe is your key to success?
Sure. And before I answer, I'll hit you with one more name. It's actually Sean Alexander Darling Hammond.
Sean Alexander.
27 letters.
Wow. I have you beat. I'm 32 letters.
I know. Look, you can't fit on the SAT.
No, I cannot.
Yeah, you're five letters over. Yeah. I'm just within it.
Yeah.
So I know. my D is right at the end.
Yeah.
My training is different in the same way that everyone's training is different. I did something before Ninja and I don't want to stop doing it. So I think Drew is so into commitment and parkour that he always mixes that in. And everyone's got their thing that they're into. And for me, it's climbing. So I'm so addicted to rock climbing that if I were to stop doing it for a week, I would feel like something's off. Whoa. So I got to get to the climbing gym. I got to do campus workouts. So it's like when you're climbing without your feet.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I've always loved. And it translates so well to Ninja that it's kind of like I'm cheating on climbing with Ninja, but no one knows.
Okay.
So it's been working out pretty well. Like Ninja's my side chick. But but climbing, I still love you.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been doing a lot is just I find routes that are challenging by themselves if you use your feet. but within the realm of possibility of climbing without them, and I just throw myself at them until I figure it out.
Well, you talk about rock climbing being your love, but we all know that your true love is your wife, Valentina.
Yeah.
How is that being married, being a ninja, going out there, going to school? As a married man, I know there's only so much time, and you know, you got to be able to make time for your wife, whether it's date night or whatever. How have you made time for being a family man? I mean, being a married man, how does that work?
It's really about making sacrifices when you need to, obviously. Like, marriage is a sacrifice, and it's making sure you're there for the person. But it's also like scheduling, which doesn't sound sexy at all. But like, legit, the way that I make sure I get it all in is I put it on my calendar. So if I want to make sure that I'm around home and I'm spending time with my wife, that's the thing I'm going to do every Wednesday and Friday and Sunday night. I'm going to be home. I'm going to be hanging out. I'm going to be available to help with whatever needs to be done. And if people are like, hey, you want to go train? You want to see a movie? I'm like, on Tuesday, maybe. On Thursday, maybe.
I like that. So you're intentional about not only your training, but what's more important is your relationship with your wife, because so many people aren't as intentional as they'd like to be. The idea is there, but the truth is that they kind of fly by the seat of their pants. Like, oh yeah, I'll just react to this request and I'll react to that request and not have a plan in mind. And you plan that out in your calendar. So I pulled up your iPhone right now and looked through your calendar, I will see a date committed for your
wife. You'll
see
the gaps, and the gaps are hers. That's how it works. Yeah. Anytime it's not committed is her time. And she'll tell you, I'm not a paragon. Like, I'm a work in progress, but that is what I'm working towards, is being extremely available and accessible and really building the most important relationship I'll ever have, which is the one with my wife.
All right, now keep it real. Give me a story of when Ninja got you in trouble at home with your wife.
Oh.
Or should I make that plural? Stories.
I got one right off the top of my head, man.
Okay.
This is the last time Valentina came to a non-NBC Ninja event. She came to Mike Cook's backyard ninja competition in North Carolina. We drove there together, and it was a 3-day thing. And little did I know that she would have to be sitting outside in the boiling North Carolina sun for 3 days with no one to talk to, nothing to do. And she wasn't happy about that. You know, I'm off like training, having a good time.
You brought me out here for this?
Yeah. She's like, you know, can you spend time with me? I'm like, yeah, sure. And then they call my name to compete. I'm like, right after this. And that just kept happening. And we're driving home. It's a long drive from North Carolina to Washington, D.C. We're living. And she's like, I'm never going to another one of those events. And we just sat there in silence for a bit. And I was like, yeah, that's understandable.
She was
she's really magnanimous and very forgiving. So she wasn't like mean about it, but I could tell she had not enjoyed herself. Right. And I didn't want to put her through that again.
Wow. You had her out in the, and it was probably humid too.
It was terrible.
Yeah.
She came back like ridden with bug bites, dehydrated. Just, it wasn't fun.
Any sunburn?
Yeah. Ooh. We both had it. Oh. We both had it. She's darker than me and she still got burned. So it was bad.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, now we know Ninja got Sean, Darling, and Hammond.
It happens.
In trouble a couple times. Huh?
Yeah, no, I mean, you gotta pick your battles. A lot of ninjas have the benefit of, like Jamie and Kim both love going to these kinds of events. Jamie Ron and Kim Ron, so they go together, and it's fun for both of them. For my wife, she loves climbing, right? So we traveled to Thailand and we climbed there. We've traveled, where else we went? Red Rocks in Nevada. We've climbed a bunch. Italy, we climbed there for our honeymoon. That's what we can do together. That's really fun. It's kind of ninja related for me.
Yeah.
So that's where I put my chips there, because she has a fun time.
4 seasons on American Ninja Warrior. And look, you're not getting any younger. 33 years old. We've now lowered the age requirement to 19 years old. How have you trained as far as keeping up with the newer generation of ninjas? I know that you said earlier that you had to change your workout regimen. You had to work out smarter. How are you working out smarter as you're getting older?
Yeah, so it's funny. You'll appreciate this, because I know you did that the year without processed sugar. You asked me about exercise, but a bigger part of it is like what you eat and what you do when you sleep and all that. That's
Hold on,
really
ninjas pay attention to their diet?
I mean, some of us do. Like, some of us are young enough, they don't have to, but a lot of us do. And I feel like that's been one of the bigger changes. Like, I don't eat any processed sugar during the season. Don't eat beef. Don't eat lamb. Don't eat pork, which is crazy because I love bacon cheeseburgers so much. No sweets. And that allows my muscles to recover a lot faster. It allows me to sleep better. Allows me to stay more focused. And all that stuff adds up. You know, all it takes is to feel a little bit sluggish and you feel an obstacle and your season's over. So I've definitely made sacrifices on the diet front and tried to get really educated about it. You know, sort of we talked about education before, but I feel like education is the process by which people realize enlightenment that allows them to have a richer life. And for me, that's been true with the diet stuff. I learned as much as I could, and it's really helped me. But then on the training side, right, because that's important. You can't just eat right and suddenly do the salmon ladder. You got to train. I've been very intentional about how many days I train a week that are really hard on the joints. So Ninja's really, really hard on the joints. I only do that 3 days a week. So I have to take a day off in between my Ninja training.
Okay.
So even this time of year when I'm training for Vegas, I'll do like Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'll do 2 days that are Ninja. But Wednesday has to be off. Friday has to be off so that I give my joints that time to get that lubrication back, get that strength back. Otherwise, you can really hurt yourself and be out of the game for weeks.
Yeah, I say this all the time. Resting is just as important as training. But when you're younger, you think you got to just go, 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 go. And I'm glad that you even mentioned how hard it is on your joint.
Oh, yeah.
Was there ever a time in your four seasons that you've actually had to work through an injury?
Yep, this season. I was doing a big fly into the cliffhanger at Apex. It was like 10 feet into the cliffhanger, flying through the air. And normally when you're doing that, all you're thinking about is catch, 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 catch that thing. You're not thinking about what happens if you miss it. So I hit it and it was a little sweaty. So I just slipped right off, landed on my shoulder and partially dislocated my left shoulder.
Mm.
And, you know, that's a pretty important joint right there.
Yeah.
So I had to find a chiropractor in the area. I got really educated on cupping and Graston and learned how to do the work on it I needed to do when I wasn't working with a chiropractor. But I'm stronger than ever, fortunately, because they helped me not just deal with that injury, but other things in my body that I didn't realize were creeping up.
This year, I mean, you're back on fire. Minneapolis, you dominate in the qualifying round. You complete it again. We're so used to seeing you hit that buzzer. But talk to me about the finals. I know so badly you want to be able to hit that buzzer in the finals. It's escaped you now for 4 years.
Yeah, I went into the season with two goals. One was a finisher's badge and one was getting to stage three. One still in my sights, so I'm not giving up. But that finisher badge was a tough one to let go of. Yeah, man, I got to obstacle 9, the Iron Maiden, and pegboards are my jam. So this should have been a comfortable place for me. But I think I got a little too excited.
Yeah.
The way the Iron Maiden works is the pegs have different friction. So the first two moves have this rubber on them, so it's very easy to hold onto it and not sort of slip out. Every move as you go down has less friction, so it's very easy to have the peg slide out. So I was so focused on making fast moves that I made the first two moves, got on the slicker pegs, and pulled the pegs right off the obstacle.
That's a hard obstacle. Just looking at it, especially at that angle that you guys are going on the decline.
Yep. Yeah. If your hips get too far back. Right. If you think about it in terms of sort of what happens if your hips are back and you're holding something that slides, well, you slide.
Yeah.
And I slid right down into the water. I was still holding the pegs when I landed. I'm just looking at them like, well, these are useless now.
But, you know, so this is what I want to know. Do you go through the technique? Now, clearly this is the day after, so you can now think about, oh, what I did, how I could have made it better. But when you don't have an opportunity to get on this course and you see this, how do you make all those mental adjustments on what your body needs to do when you're not out there, up there physically doing it? You don't know until you actually get out there.
Yeah. See, feel, do. That's what you do.
Yeah.
So you imagine in your head. You try to feel it in your body. You literally like tense the muscles as you visualize what you're going to do. And then you try to execute on what you've planned. See, feel, do. Mike Bernardo taught me that.
See, feel, do.
Yeah, that is, I think one of, you know, talking about commitment and backflips and things like that, that is one of the most powerful tools I've learned. It's to sort of imagine your body from a third person view, like you're playing a video game, and see yourself do it. And then actually let yourself tense up and flex those things in time. Because then you realize like, oh, if I don't want to slip backwards, I have to tense this part of my core or I'm going to sag.
But you don't know that when you're watching somebody, though.
You might.
You might.
You might if you really pay close attention. I mean, the nice thing is after a few years, you've done a lot of movements and you can sort of extrapolate from what you've done to try to get a sense of what something you have to do will feel like or what you'll have to do to make sure you move the right way. So you might have a sense, and you know, you take your best guess, but most of the time, ninjas are right. You know, you see, you feel, you do.
Well, I like that. See, feel, do. What has Ninja brought to your life that's been unexpected? Whether it's the celebrity, whether it's your friends that you grew up with, maybe some of the kids who, you know, maybe bullied you during the, has it changed your life dramatically?
Yeah, it has. I think it's been a continuation of a trajectory, or it's been a continuation of a trajectory that I was on but didn't realize it. I've always been trying to grow my human family and be connected to people no matter their background. Ninja is this crazy little community where you've got people who voted for Trump and people who voted for the Green Party who are best buds. And America's not like that right now. Like, there are these divisions that feel intractable. And it is amazing to be in a community where we are so bought in to the notion that this person rocks, that we don't care about their beliefs as a demonstration of their value as a person, right? So I was in Colorado just a week ago, and me and a buddy of mine were talking about politics, and it's very clear we had different beliefs, but it didn't mean we're not friends. It didn't mean that we couldn't talk about it respectfully and then immediately get psyched about the ninja course in the season. Like, that's a really remarkable thing, and I think America needs more of that. So what's been surprising for me about Ninja is it's made me expand my human family even more. And I think America really needs more of that right now.
Wow, that's powerful. That is so powerful, because you look at how tense our culture is now, and the climate today isn't the same thing that is being reflected in the ninja community. And hopefully, maybe one day we'll get to the point where we can agree to disagree and still be able to have that Sean Alexander Darling Hammond love. Where can folks find you on social media?
Yeah, so I am on Instagram as @TheGivingNinja and on Facebook as well, The Giving Ninja.
Thank you so much for your time. This has been great. I've learned so much about you. And now when I see the smile and I see the hearts, I know exactly where that's coming from. This is Sean Darling Hammond. Uh-oh, I got to go government. Sean Alexander Darling Hammond. Thank you so much, man. I appreciate this.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
This is good. The Giving Ninja.
Absolutely loved that conversation over almost 50 letters between the two of you. But there were so many things he said that stuck out with me. One of the things I loved, the doubt was stronger than hope. And he had to change that.
Yeah.
And to consciously go about it, I thought, and for what I really related to was him talking about how he got into a career that he thought was going to be fulfilling in law and realized it wasn't suiting his purpose. And that's something that I could totally relate to walk away from that and now go to public policy and to say, instead of worrying about debt, worry about making children feel loved. Worry about making a difference.
And that came from a place where he and I were able to connect that, you know, we had similar backgrounds, growing up in tough inner city schools, being able to see the way people were being treated, the way the school system kind of failed some of the students in the inner city. And that public policy, you know, that you have this feeling that he's made a big change on the Ninja Warrior community and that he's going to make a big change in his community as well.
Absolutely. He's one of the so many athletes headed to Vegas, because now we're done playing.
Right.
Now it gets serious. It's $1 million on the line.
Matt, this
you hit a
is
buzzer,
our Super Bowl.
This is it.
This
you
is
hit
it.
A buzzer or you go home. And I'm so excited. Last year, we only had 9 finishers in the city finals. This year, 28 people hit a buzzer on the city finals. We're headed into Vegas, and I am feeling as confident as ever that we're going to see another American Ninja Warrior.
And
someone get to the top of stage.
And the question is, who's going to be that guy or that woman to be able to get up to the rope and become
woman.
The next American Ninja Warrior? And I truly believe that if there's any year that's going to happen, it's going to be this year. But it's not going to come without a lot of pressure. I've been around a lot of big events before, the Super Bowl. I've been to the Kentucky Derby. I've seen a lot of big things. I'm telling you, there's nothing more pressure-packed than the American Ninja Warrior National Finals. One mistake and you're done. It's not like football where you get multiple downs. You don't get that.
And what's amazing is now that we've lowered the age requirement, we've got some young guns coming in, the new class ninjas. And we talked about some of these 19-year-olds like Matisse, the kid, Awadi.
Matthew Day.
These guys are going to be facing something, a level of pressure, I think, that they kind of came in under the radar. Matisse had a little bit of expectations, but now it's real. And now we'll see what kind of fortitude they have. And I had a chance to speak to Makoto Nagano. And for those who don't know, he was one of the originals from Sasuke, the show, where he was one of the first to achieve total victory. And he said no one will ever do it on their first chance because it's not physical, it's the mental element they lack. So these rookies are going to be in for a real challenge. And that's not just the young ones.
Right.
You got guys like Brian Rambo. Rambo is going to be
or
racing
Abby
in his 30s.
Clark, who showed so much promise, so much success, and to think that the success can be repeated, you know, for a lot of these ninjas, getting through and getting past stage one is going to be a big deal, especially for the young guys. And then it's going to be about how do you maintain that tempo? How do you sit there and try to preserve your energy so you don't blow it out?
Well,
because there are four stages in the national finals.
And what I love is Alyssa Beard is back.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse Graff is
Megan
back.
Megan Martin.
Well, Alyssa and Jesse, the only two who've completed stage one. And we got Megan Martin, who's come so close. Flex LeBrec is back, who went out on the cargo net last year on stage one. I think we've got a lot of women. Not have a chance to get through stage one, but I think stage two will fall to a woman this year. And then stage three, especially if someone like Megan Martin or Barclay Stockett gets on
there. If you let any of those rock climbers or any of the ones who have great agility and body awareness onto stage three, we could see a woman get to stage four and get up to the top and hit that buzzer.
I mean, when we look at people like Josh Levin coming out, Joe Morovsky, Drew Dreschel, I think the Godfather, David Campbell at 40 years of age, Travis Rosen
competing against people half
their age.
But pump the brakes, though, because remember, there's a little bit of time in between the last finals and Las Vegas. They have to take care of their bodies.
Absolutely.
They've been going hard at it for so long. They must take care of their bodies. And if they're overtraining, they could burn out in Vegas.
Well, that's where I think the experience will be an advantage. But that's why I can't wait to see what happens in Las Vegas.
$1 million.
There's going to be stage one. You're going to see two episodes of stage one. And then it's all in.
Yes.
It's all in. Stages two, three, hopefully stage four.
And that's
we don't
Mount
even know.
Midoriyama. We haven't said that name in a long time, but if you can get up Mount Midoriyama, oh, baby, you're rich.
Let's face it. Isaac Calderaro has left the door open with that shocking fall
in
Indianapolis.
Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine?
So now, if anyone does it, they're going to join the ranks. We're going to crown someone new with that $1 million
Matt,
or
think about
multiple
the confidence.
People.
Think about the confidence of the ninjas when they saw Isaac Calderaro go down. Now it's their opportunity to get back, to get in the finals and conquer.
Well, the next step, these ninjas, it starts next Monday night, the national finals of
American Ninja Warrior.
Don't miss it, brother. That got a little WWE there, didn't it?
Well, you know me, Gene.
Enjoy it, folks.
This has been the American Ninja Warrior Podcast.
That's right. Follow along on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Ninja Warrior.
And watch American Ninja Warrior.